Hello, it's Thursday 15th of April. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On this week's show, Gary Bauman of Check In Asia and I will be talking all things travel and tourism in Singapore. So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So, today we're taking a virtual trip from our KL base down the Malay Peninsula to Singapore, a city-state and an island with a causeway connection to Malaysia, which is its only land border. Singapore has been the region's most innovative and probably forward-thinking country in travel and tourism in our region up until the pandemic, but obviously everything is changing right now. So what does the future hold for a country that has been unable to rely on domestic tourism during this pandemic? So Hannah, as we normally do, before we start looking forward, let's take a little bit of a look back at some of the statistics and what happened since 2010, when, you know, quite a lot has changed in Singapore since 2010, when Singapore opened up its two integrated resorts.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all sorts has happened since then. And I think you've been tracking that a little bit more closely than I have. So you tell our listeners what have been the big changes.
Yeah, well, I mean, going back a little bit even further, the first time I visited, I don't know when the first time you visited Singapore, Hannah, the first time I visited was 2006. I was living in Shanghai at the time, and Singapore was promoting itself quite heavily into the Chinese market, but as a shopping destination. All the countries around the world at that time were really focusing on Chinese outbound travelers' preference for shopping when they were overseas, and Singapore was promoting Orchard Road pretty much exclusively. It was promoting also Chinatown and also the Botanical Gardens, but it really did focus quite a lot on the shopping element of Orchard Road. And then that shifted as these integrated resorts, Marina Bay Sands, so the whole redevelopment of Marina Bay and the Resorts World down in Sentosa really changed the whole landscape. And at that point, that was quite an interesting time. 2010 was just after the world financial crisis, which had a big impact on travel across Asia Pacific for sure. The numbers into Singapore, I think in 2008, 2009, were down than they were previous to that. And obviously the whole region was looking for a reboot in terms of what travel could be for the next decade, because there was this idea, particularly with the growth of China and a little bit later India too, that there was this transformation coming in travel and tourism, particularly in Southeast Asia. Destinations were looking at new ways to really tap into that. And I think Singapore probably was at the forefront of that. So if we go back to 2010, Hannah, we've had a look at a few statistics there, and there was real growth, wasn't there, through the last decade?
Yeah, I mean, so 2010, Singapore saw about 11.6 million arrivals. 2015, 15.2. 2019, 19.1 million. So, you know, they've added a good 8 million visitors in just a decade, which is really, really impressive growth. And like you say, the share of markets has changed. So in 2019, China was the biggest inbound market for them. It accounted for about 3.6 million inbound tourists, followed by Indonesia, India, and Malaysia. And of course, Malaysia has always been a really, really important inbound market for them. But it's, in the past decade or so, it's becoming less important, I would say.
Yeah, and you look at the top 10 markets in particular, definite shift towards Asia Pacific. Only two of the top 10 markets in 2019 were outside of Asia Pacific. That was the US, which was number 8, and the UK at number 10. As you mentioned, we go down to number 4 was Malaysia. Below that was Australia, Japan, Philippines, then the USA, South Korea, UK, and Vietnam at number 11, Thailand number 12, Hong Kong 13. So there really was a focus on attracting more travelers from across the region. I think one of the interesting things that Singapore Tourism Board had done in the early part of the last decade, it kind of focused quite a lot on the second and third tier cities in mainland China, and it saw a lot of growth from doing that. And then towards the latter half of the decade, it did the same kind of thing in India and sort of spread its growth from across India into Singapore, which was also pretty successful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and if we're looking, you know, what happened last year, of course, it was a washout. And Singapore, you know, we've talked about this before. Singapore was one of the first countries to really be hit by COVID outside of China very, very early on. So already from February, there are a lot of restrictions in terms of inbound travelers into the country. And from March, the border's pretty much closed. So it's been a, like we were just saying, it's what do you do in a tiny island nation where most people do outbound travel? Of course, there's only so much travel domestically travellers can do, only so many staycations you can take. So, I mean, to be fair to Singapore, I think we have seen a number of really innovative domestic traveller focused tours that have sprung up, or other products that are coming up, just to kind of capture the imagination of Singaporean travellers and try to encourage them to spend their money and to stay domestically in the country when otherwise they might just stay at home.
Yeah, I think another thing that we've seen, perhaps maybe people around the region didn't quite understand the degree of this before COVID-19, is obviously Singapore, as you say, doesn't really have a domestic tourism market because it's so small. It's very inbound and outbound travel focused. The Changi Airport, which, you know, wins so many awards as the world's best airport, it's very well connected, connecting east and west. Also connects across Asia Pacific. You know, there's huge numbers of connecting flights across the region. But I think the other thing that has come out over this last year is just how important the aviation sector and Changi Airport is to the whole economy of Singapore. I don't think that was quite realized before. Beyond travel, you know, so much in terms of supply chains comes in through the port and through the airport, which really stimulate and invigorate the nation. And particularly about a year ago, when China was basically closed down, there was no supply chains throughout Southeast Asia, the decline in numbers through Changi really, really hurt all sectors of the economy.
Yeah, I mean, and even if we're looking at February now, so we're almost a year into their borders being closed, Changi Airport's February 2021 traffic is still minus 96.6% down year on year. Isn't that crazy? They just carried 118,000 people only. And for it to still be so down, I think it really shows the impact of Singapore not having that domestic aviation market to support it.
So there are two sides to Singapore's urgency to open up. You know, there is the economic side, the fact that it doesn't have a particularly large population, so it should be able to roll out the vaccines quite quickly. But it really needs to get its airport and its Singapore Airlines functioning at a much higher level again. As we've said on the pod several times, Hannah, they have actually made several attempts in different ways to at least partially reopen their air economy. But it's just being defeated by other nations being very cautious, and also the virus.
I think the one thing that Changi Airport and Singapore Airlines has got going for them is that the government really recognises its pivotal role, like you were saying, in the Singaporean economy. And we're constantly seeing government rhetoric saying things like Changi Airport is the, you know, the lifeblood, is the lungs, is the heart of Singapore. And they really see this status of Singapore as a transit city to be key in ensuring its competitiveness long term. So there have been a lot of measures that the government have put forward in terms of financial measures and other things to really support the aviation industry and the tourism industry in general. They're probably some of the more generous subsidies that we've seen region-wide. So there are things like a 50% wage subsidy, which is then topped up by aviation workforce retention grants and things. There are landing charge rebates on ground handling companies, even a lot of training schemes that are going on too. So the government has really been trying to support this aviation industry and make sure that it doesn't go under.
So let's look at some of the things that it has been trying to do, Hannah. And obviously, the headline story was last year, was the Hong Kong-Singapore air travel bubble, which there was huge hype around the region. There was hopes at the time that it was going to stimulate more movement in terms of travel across Southeast Asia and perhaps Asia Pacific as well, but it didn't happen. It faltered just almost on takeoff, wasn't it, really, back in November. And then it got put onto the back burner, but it looks like it might be coming back into play.
It does, doesn't it? There's suddenly been a lot more talk around it. Hong Kong have definitely been discussing it this week. In the news, even just this morning, I think there was news from the Transport Minister that Hong Kong and Singapore are in active discussions. They are finalising the agreements, and apparently Hong Kong is only having discussions with Singapore on the concept of air travel bubbles. It really looks like Hong Kong is pinning its hopes on getting this up and running.
But things have changed quite a lot in the 4 or 5 months since the original version was postponed. And the main development, of course, is vaccination. And it's looking perhaps that if this travel bubble is rebooted, it might not just be just the quarantine-free version of late 2020. There may be a vaccinated component to it.
Yeah, interestingly, it seems like the vaccination side is mainly coming from Hong Kong. Hong Kong are asking Singaporeans to be vaccinated to come in. But so far, we haven't seen Singapore say the same actually about Hong Kong travellers coming into the country. They haven't said that they will have to be vaccinated. So it would definitely be very interesting to see how that plays out. Is Singapore going to insist on this to kind of be on an equal basis, or are they going to say no and use it almost as a test case for how can you reopen to countries that are also not vaccinated yet?
Yeah, I have a bit of theory about that, because another thing that's changed in recent months, Hong Kong's primary goal was to reopen its border with mainland China. Now, that looks as though that may happen in late April, perhaps early May, without a quarantine for Chinese citizens that go into Hong Kong if they are vaccinated. But this comes back to another issue that we've been talking about quite a lot, Hannah, is that Hong Kong and mainland China are using the same vaccines. Singapore isn't, is it?
No. So Singapore is mainly using Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And in fact, they actually have had a supply of Sinovac delivered, but they have not yet granted it emergency use. And they've had this supply for a good couple of months now, and they still haven't authorized it yet. Whether they're going to, there's a big question mark. They keep saying that they are waiting for data, and they keep saying that they need to really make sure that they're not just going to approve any vaccine due to political pressure. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. Singapore has said that even the types of vaccines need to be looked at very carefully in terms of whether different measures for quarantine or stay home notices, as they're called in Singapore, will need to be applied. So this could well be a stumbling block, I suppose.
Yeah, watch this space. That one has probably got a lot more mileage in it. So let's look what actually has happened, Hannah. And this week there was some news about the air travel pass and the numbers of visitors that have come into Singapore over since August last year, I think, when this initiative was first unveiled. And the figures aren't great, are they? I mean, it's 18,200 total visitors to Singapore. 12,800 of those are from China, 2,400 from Australia. I was a bit surprised about that. And 1,100 from Vietnam. Now, I didn't realize that you did know this, I know. But currently, the air travel pass system is only open to Australia, Brunei, mainland China, New Zealand, and Taiwan, because Vietnam was suspended on February the 9th. Do you think that this will get developed a bit further, or is there no real mileage in this, do you think?
I mean, I think we definitely will see more countries being added to this list. So essentially the air travel pass is almost a unilateral opening. So it's one-sided. It's Singapore saying to these countries, if you enter Singapore, you don't have to undergo a stay home notice. You do have to undergo, you know, RT-PCR tests and things, but there's no quarantine period, essentially. But the crucial point for this, and this is why the numbers are quite so low, is because countries like Australia and Brunei and China and New Zealand and Taiwan, even Vietnam, before it was stopped, don't allow Singaporean travellers in without vaccination, or those returning from Singapore. So that would include Vietnamese people travelling to Singapore who could get into Singapore, go around with no quarantine, but when they go back, they would then face quarantine. And that's the big issue. So, you know, I think that the transport minister has been questioned quite a bit over why Singapore has decided to do this kind of one-sided opening. But it seems like they're very much seeing this as a welcome. They're very much seeing this as a kind of a standing invitation to countries and saying, look, when you are ready and you do want to open up to us, we will be there. You're already welcome in our country. It's up to us. And actually, if you look at some of these countries now, Australia, Taiwan, both of these countries are talking about setting up air travel bubbles with Singapore. So the kind of slowdown with that, if you like, is not from Singapore's side. Singapore already lets these travellers in without quarantine. The holdup is from Australia's side, it's from Taiwan's side. And those are the countries that have got to figure out what to do with Singaporean travellers or people returning from Singapore when they come in.
And it also works the other way. The transport minister said something quite interesting about the UK. I don't know if you saw that. He said that at the moment, the UK is offering the same standing invitation to Singaporean travellers. But Singapore at the moment isn't permitting UK travellers into Singapore. But he did say that because the UK had opened up this invitation to Singaporean travellers, once the UK's rate, which is coming down quite fast because the vaccinations are really rolling out pretty quickly, once Britain gets a handle on this, UK travellers would be welcome back to Singapore quite quickly, and they would like to move quite quickly on that. So, yeah, it's an interesting concept because it's quite forward thinking, whereas, you know, most of what we hear in our region at the moment is we've got to get this done, we've got to work on this almost immediately. this is a much more phased and progressive thing that they've been working on in Singapore over several months. And, you know, the fruition of this may not come until later in the year, but they've actually laid the groundwork.
Yeah, and I think the other interesting concept about this is it's almost generosity. I think, and I keep ranting about this, I think on the podcast, about so many countries who are trying to set up these travel bubbles, and say Indonesia wanting to do the Batam Bintan travel corridor with Singapore is a perfect example of this, who are only seeing it in terms of inbound tourism. This is a little bit more generous, right, from Singapore. This is not so much, you know, they know right now that there's nothing in it for them, but they're going to do it anyhow. And not only crucially that, but they will also allow their travellers, they would allow Singaporeans to travel to these countries too and back. But, you know, countries like Indonesia, who is setting up this Batam Bintam travel corridor, it's very much Singaporeans to Batam Bintam for their tourism dollars. And that's it. There's no reciprocity.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's quite a smart strategy. And I do think that when the world does move towards some degree of normalization, Singapore will reap the benefits from this. So let's look at one area, Hannah, where there has been success in terms of domestic travel, and that's the cruise sector, which has been incredibly successful in Singapore.
Yeah, I mean, a story that I loved that came out in the media last week was that Singaporeans now account for 1/3 of the world's global cruise travelers. It's just astounding. So since these cruises to nowhere launched, more than 120,000 people have actually sailed on them. So these are operated by Royal Caribbean and Genting Cruise Lines, and they're kind of sharing the cruises between them. They're very short. I think maximum is 2 nights, but they're really popular. Lots of people have gone on them. And anecdotally, I've seen people mention, oh, you know, I've gone on a cruise and I would never have even considered cruising as an option for me, you know, pre-pandemic. But actually, I went on it and I kind of liked it. And maybe later on, I might consider going on another cruise, even in non-pandemic times. So it's been pretty neat because, of course, we've seen so much negative press around cruises last year. How they're a hotbed for COVID and everything else. But, you know, these cruises, 120,000 passengers, not a single one has had COVID. Of course, we had this false alarm with one passenger very early on, and a cruise ship had to return to port. But later they found it was a false positive. So this has really been an example where Singapore Tourism Board has worked very closely together with the cruise operators, and they've really demonstrated that you can reopen cruising and you can reopen it safely. But I guess the key thing is that, you know, this is still from one single country. This is a country that has very, very low transmitted cases. They have very rigorous testing before you get on board as well. So how this would then work later on, if you're talking about a fly cruise market or other nationalities coming in, it's unclear. But for right now, for Singapore, this works.
I absolutely agree. It's a very organic case of something that's worked very, very well during this specific era in a domestic context. But extrapolating that into an inbound or outbound or beyond that concept is going to be pretty different. But it has been quite interesting. I've noticed that the Royal Caribbean, as you mentioned, there are two cruise lines that are operating these cruises to nowhere, no port calls at all. They've extended their season twice. So initially it was supposed to run through till April this year. That was extended until the end of June this year. And it's just been extended again through to October 2021, which is basically a year-round cruise season for domestic cruising, which, you know, that's something that if you go back to the start of the pandemic, when a lot of these cruise ships around the world were called floating petri dishes, you just wouldn't have assumed that they would be able to pull this off.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what they're doing now is they're actually being quite innovative too. So you have Dream Cruises, who have launched its World Dream Ship, but it's a Muslim-friendly cruise ship. It's the world's first halal-friendly cruise ship in Asia Pacific. So that launched on the 11th of December. And so far, they've had about 5,000 Muslim travelers since the launch, which is pretty impressive on itself. And then they've also launched themed cruises, you know, so you can go on a Thailand themed cruise or a South Korea themed cruise, which I thought was also quite a nifty way for NTOs to do some advertising, right? And kind of promote your destination whilst you're still on this cruise and you still haven't gone anywhere. But the people kind of feel like they have, because they get to eat Korean cuisine and they get to experience Korean activities.
Yeah, and pet-friendly cruises, I think I saw as well. That's an interesting development, because pet-friendly has become a big thing in China over the last sort of 6 to 8 months. A lot of hotels are rolling out new pet-friendly services, amenities, and rules, that's become a big thing. So I think countries in Southeast Asia that are aware of this and are amenable to pet-friendly holidays, you know, need to look at what's happening in China, I think, for sure. But another big market, of course, is India. And the Singaporean Tourism Board is looking at hosting, I think, a virtual event later this year, a cruising event specifically targeted to India, which I didn't realize was Singapore's top source market for fly cruise tourism pre-COVID-19.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting move too, isn't it? I guess it's a product that they want to show off and, again, show, yeah, we've managed to operate this and we've managed to operate it safely. It's not quite clear yet whether they will be marketing the cruises to nowhere or are they going to be marketing just kind of the normal cruises that start in Singapore. But yeah, it's interesting tactic.
And another aspect that was vital to the Singapore economy, not just the tourism economy before COVID-19, is MICE, meetings, incentives, exhibitions. And really part of Singapore's strategy to reopen is focused on the MICE sector, isn't it? Obviously, with hosting the World Economic Forum special session later this year in August, I think. It really has tried to look at new ways to reopen MICE, obviously at the moment to domestic events, but it is going to host some international events too. Hybrid events as well. I think it's sort of trying to push this, something that most other countries in the region don't seem to be doing. They tend to be looking more at leisure travel, but Singapore really is focused on MICE.
It is. And then, you know, a recent conference, they were saying they know a strong MICE industry is needed. They're even planning to set up offices in Brussels and San Francisco to promote doing events in Singapore. So they clearly see this as a key pillar to generating tourism revenue. But what's quite interesting is they also came out last week and they said that they are reevaluating what kind of KPIs they can use to consider whether an event has been successful or not. So previously, they obviously looked at things like tourism receipts and the number of international attendees to total attendance. But they were talking about perhaps now they need to start looking at what the local business spend has contributed to the whole industry and also measure it in terms of knowledge and thought leadership value, which is pretty novel.
It is. And then at the same time, you read in the media that Marina Bay Sands is going to be welcoming 2,500 participants to an event later in the year, the Architecture and Building Services 2021 event. This is the biggest event that will be hosted in Singapore since COVID-19. So the KPI for that is number-based. So yeah, you know, I think we have to take these with a little bit of a pinch of salt.
No, definitely, definitely. I mean, and of course, how do you put value on thought leadership? That's pretty difficult. That's pretty subjective thing to do as well. But yes, like you say, there's a lot going on with MICE. And even in terms of the local hotels, recently, I've seen lots and lots of news articles coming out, lots of press articles about how hotels are all launching their own hybrid suites. Right, they've all got their own green screen rooms. They've got broadcasting rooms now. It seems like the hotels that are really getting very serious about investing money into hybrid events because this is something that they believe is going to continue for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. So looking at things that Singapore does do well, and it does a lot of things very, very well. But one thing it doesn't seem to have done particularly well, Hannah, is sustainability.
Again, you know, Singapore Tourism Board had a conference last week, and one of the key tenets that they were talking up was how they want to develop Singapore as a sustainable destination, and they believe that that's going to be a draw for people to come and visit the country. And they run an accelerator program already, so they're going to be also adding businesses who have sustainability focused solutions into that, which all sounds great. And of course, you know, I think you and I are all for sustainability and the development of that. But you also have to put it against the background of what's actually the current situation. So of course, they are a city state that has been reclaimed from the ocean, so already not terribly environmentally friendly. And Euromonitor actually came out with a really recent report in March, and they had the Sustainable Travel Index rankings for 2020. And Singapore, out of 99 countries, came in 93rd, just behind Indonesia, which was 92nd. So of course, you know, it's hard to know where things truly stand. But given this kind of backdrop, you know, it's behind countries like Qatar, it's behind countries like Kuwait. I think Singapore has got a long way to go.
I think the region has. If you look at the 99 countries on that list, as you say, Singapore came in 93rd. The countries below it were Philippines, Morocco, Vietnam, Mauritius, India, and Pakistan. And of the 99 countries, the highest ranked country in Southeast Asia was Laos in 51st place. So clearly, sustainability in Southeast Asia is going to have to be a bit of a focus going forward, because all of the countries in the region are in the lower half of that ranking. That's not impressive at all.
No, it isn't. I agree. I think this is something that the region really needs to work on. And it's something that's given a lot of lip service, right? In general, so you're always hearing the tourism ministries talking about how they're developing ecotourism and sustainability. But it seems that when they're actually measured on it, they're falling quite short of those aspirations.
Yeah, it's time to stop the greenwashing, isn't it? You've got to have real action. And I do think that a lot of this action will be driven by consumers, by travellers themselves going forward. I think we've mentioned this before on the pod, but consumers across Asia in particular are very aware of these issues, particularly in the products that they're purchasing online. They are looking at very much things that are biodegradable, organic, and non-polluting, non-plastic, those kinds of things. So destinations that don't live up to that, I think, they will start to see a bit of a backlash probably on social media once travel does resume. Okay, so let's wrap up this sort of Singapore wrap, Hannah, by looking at outbound travel, because Singaporean travellers are great travellers. Wherever you travel in the world, you do meet Singaporeans, whether that's Europe, whether it's Australia, whether that's Southeast Asia, wherever. And the cruise to nowhere sector, the success of that, I think really does show that Singaporeans are chomping at the bit to be able to travel again. Interestingly, Singapore Airlines is the first, I think, airline in the world to trial the new IATA travel pass. So it is looking at ways to open up the economy using a digital health pass that monitors vaccination or your testing and all that kind of thing. There's big hopes around the world that this can connect countries again. But looking at outbound markets from Singapore, obviously Malaysia is a really, really important market for Singaporean travellers, but they do travel everywhere, and destinations around will be looking at Singapore because of the way that it's managed the virus, its approach to reopening. It's a choice market, isn't it, for destinations around the world?
It is, absolutely. Like you say, I think very much in terms of the approach of the government, because again, the government have actually come out in the press and talked about allowing outbound travel, not anytime soon, but they are talking about it as a possibility, as part of the whole reopening. And that is lacking in a lot of other countries in this region. Again, it's all about inbound, not about, are we going to let our travellers out? And there have been a bunch of studies that have come out as well, lots of surveys. I think one of the latest ones was Booking.com. And this is, I don't know if you saw this stat, Gary, but I love this. They surveyed these Singaporeans, and 65% of the Singaporeans they surveyed said they would rather go on holiday in 2021 than find true love.
Yeah, well, what can you say to that?
Yeah, but certainly a lot of pent-up travel demand. And, there's a lot around how Singaporeans have been saving up their holiday. A lot of them didn't use their full annual leave last year, so they're kind of bumping that onto this year so they can take longer breaks. There's a lot about how they've been saving and likely to have bigger budgets as well for outbound travel. So I think it's just very much them waiting right now to see what countries are going to open up to them and then traveling there.
Yeah, and that's the big issue, isn't it? Which countries will open up? How will they do it? Will it be still, capped in terms of numbers of people that can travel? Will it be only through, travel agency bookings, approved tour operators, approved hotels, that kind of thing? You perhaps look at some European countries if they were going to reopen, but at the moment, it's not looking great in Europe. So, where are the options? I mean, everybody in the region, I think everybody I talk to wants to go to Australia. Australia looks to be a really prime opening destination. When it does open, it's going to have people queuing at the gate to get there, but it doesn't look like it's going to do that anytime soon.
No, I mean, although we have seen this talk, haven't we, about Singapore and Australia and opening up air travel bubbles, and Singapore Airlines is obviously very, very keen to pursue this. The only thing that might put a fly in the ointment at that is, of course, New Zealand has said, well, Australia, if you do this travel agreement with Singapore, we're going to have to review our own agreement, which makes sense, of course, because whatever they do will affect them. But it does just highlight, the kind of decisions that governments have to make right now about reopening and reopening to who, and who's going to be the best market to do that with, the best partner.
Yeah. And what do we think about Southeast Asia? And we've talked before about, this going back months, we thought that maybe Vietnam and Singapore might get something together. It hasn't happened. Malaysia and Singapore are using, I think, the same blockchain technology on their health passes. So there is some possibility there. But the trade minister in Singapore keeps saying over and over that it will only really deal with countries that have the same level of incidence of COVID-19 as Singapore. And there aren't many of those countries in the world. So that kind of rules out most countries, and it definitely rules out Thailand now. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, in Southeast Asia, like you say, it's pretty limited. Who else is at the levels of Singapore? Yeah, maybe Vietnam, maybe Brunei, maybe Laos. But they're all very small markets. For Singapore to reopen to them, I feel like they need a good economic motive to do that. And perhaps for Vietnam, yes, there would be that motivation. But whether Vietnam is in such a hurry to reopen the borders is also another big question. And I have my doubts about that right now. So, yeah, it's tricky. Israel, maybe. Everyone's going to open to Israel.
Yeah, it does look like that way, doesn't it? So Chan Chun Sing, the Minister for Trade and Industry, said last week at the Singapore Tourism Industry Conference that Singapore intends to reinvent global travel by positioning ourselves at the forefront of change and being bold in offering new tourism products and experiences. That's a great sentence. It's great PR, but it does rely on the fact of other countries reciprocating. And at the moment, Singapore can do whatever it likes. It can announce all these new attractions and stuff like that. But if people aren't going to be able to come, it's still in limbo.
Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, I still do see Singapore as a kind of leader in Southeast Asia in terms of reopening travel right now. We've talked a lot about Thailand and Indonesia coming up with lots of ideas, and they have done. But Singapore, for me, is the one who really seems to have a plan and methodical way of reopening in a very, as they always say, calibrated way. Like you say, it's difficult, isn't it? Are they going to be seen as an innovative destination? Maybe in terms of how they're reopening and how they're handling COVID, but in terms of the destination itself? I mean, Singapore is, you know, a fantastic place. I love visiting there. But when you compare it to the offerings that other countries in Southeast Asia have, geographic diversity and cultural diversity and different foods you can experience and eat, can it compare? What do you think?
Well, let's not go down the food route because that gets incredibly controversial. But Singapore is trusted. I think that's one of the things. I mean, you look at some of the traveler sentiment surveys in China in recent weeks, and there's a strong preference for countries that have handled the outbreak well, which would put Singapore, you know, high on the list. You know, as we said, with countries like Australia, New Zealand, probably Vietnam as well. So, you know, I think there is going to be demand for travel. You're right in terms of the diversity. It does seem to be looking very much towards the business event side of things. It is going to be hosting the World Economic Forum. I have a feeling, I don't know what it will be. I have a feeling there will be some globalized or regionalized announcement at the World Economic Forum, which probably surprises everybody. What that will be, I don't know. But I think Singapore is priming for that. That's still, what, 3 or 4 months away. But I don't really think we can expect much in Q2. I don't think we can expect much from anywhere in Southeast Asia in Q2. So I think it'll just be more of the same from Singapore, just chipping away, trying to create more links, create more future opportunities and grab them when they become available. But as you say, it's not a Seychelles, it's not a Maldives, it doesn't offer that holiday type experience. So yeah, it's a little bit limited in what it can do in the immediate term, I think.
But one to watch, and I'm sure one that regionally all the countries, other countries in Southeast Asia, are also keeping a very close eye on. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Singapore edition of the show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us our thoughts and comments on what we discussed or what we missed out. You can send us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us at our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep. Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com. or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please do rate and review us, because that helps other people to find the show.
So that's a wrap for this week, and we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.